Rick Mahn is locked and loaded on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Yes, TNT, today's News Talk. Today, we're talking about the news and all sorts of things. Actually, we're talking about a lot of stuff here this morning on TNT, today's News Talk, and it's all good. What a blinding first hour we had with Mats Nielsen and obviously Basil Valentine and Gemma Cooper. Going to have some more of Gemma Cooper in just a minute or two. And then, all being well, fingers and toes crossed to 20 past the hour, I'm going to be joined for the first time by Jacques Broderick from South Africa. He is a chief spokesperson for AfriForum in South Africa, also community safety specialist, close protection officer, and filmmaker. So we're going to be looking at the state of play down at the southernmost point of Africa. And then Ben Pyle will also be joining me before the end of the show to talk about what's happening in the UK at this time. Always great to have Ben on. He's been coming on here for probably about 2 years now, and always enjoy catching up with him to see what he has to say and what his take is on what's happening in the UK. So all that's still to come. So really strange story this morning. I thought I highlighted it, but I didn't because I wanted to reference this. Now, this is just pure speculation, but it brought a wry smile to my face. There was an artist who's dead now, and his name, I think, was Bob Ross. He was an American guy. Gemma's smiling and nodding. You're not going to be smiling and nodding in a minute, okay, if what I'm read about Bob Ross is true. Okay, so Bob Ross, he was like Rolf Harris. And if you know who Rolf Harris is, you know Tommy Kangaroo Dance Sport, play the didgeridoo. He was an Australian. He was dodgy as hell. All I'm going to say is, Bob Ross, allegations are coming out now that he was a mass murderer, cannibalistic serial killer. Now, these are allegations, I might add, but some people have speculated that the scenes that he painted, okay, with his sketch pad and his big palette and his big funny Afro hairstyle, the scenes that he painted were actually murder scenes where he buried multiple corpses of dead women. Yes, I kid you not. There was one place in particular, a tree. They dug up five dead bodies of women from under that tree, and it was an almost exact replica of one of the scenes that old Bob painted. And there was another one. His paintings had strange titles as well. Now, in case one of his relatives happens to be listening in this morning, I'm just saying this is all allegedly. There's no evidence for this at all, but there's an old saying as well that there's no smoke without fire. So maybe, just maybe, our Bob could be another Rolf Harris type or Jimmy Savile type. I don't know, but I have to find this video and look into it in a little bit more detail. But if it was true, it's a shocker, and this thing is gathering momentum now as people start to analyze some of the breakdowns of his scenes. So if you're a Bob Ross fan out there, sorry to potentially burst your bubble. Or maybe someone's listening in and they've been in Bob's company while he was still alive and lived tell the tale. If that's you, feel free to get in contact with me, rickmahn@tntradio.live, and I'd be happy to have you on the show, and you can give us your experiences with dear old Bob. So we've got to take a brief pause on that totally random note, and welcome Gemma in to get her her reaction to that. She's went from smiling to horror in the space of 30 seconds. Sorry to do that to you, Gemma, but yeah, this is Locked and Loaded. That's what you should expect when you come on or live with me in the mornings. And just going to have to deal with it. And I'm going to let you process that. And we'll speak to you in a minute here on TNT, today's News Talk.
Keeping the commitment 24/7.
I've been in the car all day and I got to listen.
Can't get enough of it.
You guys are doing a great job.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
So, Bob Ross, has your bubble been burst this morning or what?
Oh, my God. Mm-hmm. Now, I watched Bob Ross, for the love of painting, is rerunning on a cable channel in the UK in the evenings. And I'm an avid fan. I have been for years and years and years. But I did also sometimes think, is he too good to be true, Bob Ross? Because he's all like, he's former military man, isn't he? And he left the army behind. And he came out and he went into painting and he did very well. Huge, the Bob Ross empire, and his son followed in his footsteps. But when he's painting, he's such a gentle soul and he rescues animals, just like Rolf Harris was on Animal Hospital. Now you're saying this, the parallels. But he was always really like Listen, you create what you want on the canvas. It's your world. You know, dig inside yourself for inspiration. And the paintings are beautiful. I don't want this to be true. But then when someone has a persona, and it was a persona, because he was like perfect, you know, with his painting and his gentle descriptions. When someone has a persona, what's behind the mask? Now, I don't know where this story has come from. It's the first I've heard of it. But whoever's doing this digging about the scenes that he painted and the alleged serial killers or bodies of women, he painted a lot of paintings. So maybe there will be similarities with some remote rural wilderness crime scenes, maybe, because he did paint so much. But you know, if it is and he's taking his secrets to Beyond the Grave, I mean, God, I was going to watch it tonight because I'm not feeling well. I thought I'll watch an episode of Bob Ross, The Joy of Painting, to cheer me up.
I'll send you, I found it, by the way, I found it here. So there's this clip that I'll send you. It's only a couple of minutes long. It said, so there's a theory that Bob Ross is a serial killer. Everybody knows he's sweet and innocent, but there's a theory that the landscapes and the paintings that Bob paints are actually locations he used to store the bodies of his victims. So there, it might be a stretch, you might be thinking, but there are some strange coincidences that give this theory credibility amongst his paintings, called happy little accidents, is what he describes one of them as, happy little accidents, that apart actually location five dead women under the same tree that appear in the painting, happy little accidents. Their bodies were missing, and it doesn't stop there, as there have been other paintings, such as one called Betrayal, and grief, to match up with real life places where other victims of murders have been found in the same location. So listen, this is just a little bit crazy and off the wall, but it caught my attention. And because of the amount of people whose veneer is slipping at the minute, Gemma, and the amount of revelations that we're getting, and people are gasping going, what, that guy? Are you serious? I think the amount of sociopaths, psychopaths, manipulators, and twisters out there is much higher than we think. And I think the statistics are roughly 10% of the population is deemed to be psychopathic or have psychopathic tendencies. That doesn't mean they're going out killing people, but they're manipulative. They're twisters that step over you to get somewhere. I think maybe even 10% might be a lowball figure. I think maybe the figure's closer to about 40 or 50%. Some of the people I've met and experienced over the last 12 months, Gemma.
Well, I definitely agree with you on the figure being higher than 10%. Absolutely. I think we live in a narcissistic, psychopathic culture, and it's encouraged. That's what social media is all about. You know, it could be somebody who's got a lot of time on their hands deciding to research this. And he painted so many paintings and they are wilderness paintings. That's what he's famous for, landscape paintings. So it would be a stretch to think it's a coincidence if there's more than one or two. But then you can bring similarities in with landscapes to a lot of things. So I'm going to have to go and look at this story myself. But I would say as well, sometimes even I did think, is he too good to be true? Because he just seems like this perfect guy and happy little accidents. I'm not sure that was the title of a painting. I watched quite a lot of his programs. It was when he would get something wrong on canvas. He'd say, oh, don't worry, there's no such thing as wrong, just happy little accidents. You know, you can correct it and stuff like that. I don't think there's a painting called Happy Little Accident. There might be. But I wonder, I don't know if his son is still alive, because he was at his height in the 1980s. And his son then was to come on and help him sometimes. And he was still relatively young, his 20s or 30s. So, and there is a chance Bob Ross's son, who I think is called Bob Ross Jr., possibly, could be mistaken on that. He might still be alive. So he would be the one to ask. We never saw Bob Ross's wife. I have to say that. We never see her on the shows. We do see a lot of the animals that he takes in and looks after and rescues them and mends their broken legs and their broken wings and then releases them back. But, you know, Jeffrey Dahmer used to like animals before he killed them. A lot of psychopaths, they have a good relationship with animals. It's people they can't bear.
Here's another thing. Here's another thing, right? And I've just highlighted this and I've just copied it and I'm going to send this picture to you right now, okay? This is a picture of Bob Ross with his pet squirrels. It is the most sinister picture you've ever seen in your life. He looks like the epitome of evil in this picture. And he's got the squirrels on his chest, Gemma, with one tail up each nostril, giving a very Ted Bundy-esque, Fred West-esque expression on his face. I've just sent that to you. Now, you look at that picture and you tell me that guy doesn't look like he's capable of having a happy little accident with a human being, never mind his paintings. So anyway, you see what I'm talking about?
I do. And look at his eyes in that picture.
Evil. Yeah,
Yeah. Oh, no, Rick, no.
His little squirrels that he healed their broken wounds. Maybe, I'm just speculating again, maybe he captured them, injured them, and then took a perverse pleasure out of that. Yeah, as evil as they come. Yeah, you look at those eyes and you tell me, would you be happy for Bob to drop around to your house to paint a little portrait of Gemma Cooper with his little friendly squirrels on his shoulder? I wouldn't have that guy anywhere near me, let alone a woman. And of course, like I said, happy little accidents, grief and betrayal. Yeah, you tell me. Anyway, I'm totally leading you off the path here. I'm on a complete random stream of consciousness this morning. But anyway, nothing's shocking anymore. Nothing's shocking, Gemma.
Well, I'm telling you what, if that story turns out to be true, that's an epic story. It's huge, huge. I mean, he was massive. The Joy of Painting. You can go and look it up. It's on YouTube. It's huge, huge. Well, I'll bring some other headlines to the table. None of them.
Bring some real news, not just Rick Munn's speculation about a man who's dead and can't defend himself and had two squirrels on his shoulders. Yes, let's move on to some real news this morning and see what we've got.
Okay. Well, this is broken since we were last on air, and it's a follow-up to a story that you, me, and Natalie Cheel, when she was with us here on Open Line, when the show was Open Line, we discussed this story at length, and now there's been a resolution to it. It's basically the Muslim student at a London school who took a challenge to the High Court over a prayer ban, Islamic prayer ban. The judge has ruled this morning here in the UK against her and in favour of the school, Michaela School in London, against the ban on Islamic prayer rituals. The school has come out with a very, very forthright response. So that's the conclusion to that story, which we've been following since last year. The tobacco and vape bill, Rishi Sunak's controversial bill to stop anyone who was born after the 1st of January 2009, being able to buy tobacco products when they become of legal age. That is being debated within the next 10 minutes time in the House of Commons. MPs will vote on it today. A lot of Tory backbenchers are going to rebel against this, but Labour and Lib Dems have already pledged to support it. So it is likely to go through, but it's not without its controversy this morning here in the UK. And also Humza Yousaf, Scotland's first minister, he's come out this morning talking about his controversial hate crime bill. He's today said that it's all the fault of bad actors who've made vexatious complaints under this new bill. Within the first week since being launched on April the 1st, had more than 7,000 complaints. Only 240 were real hate crimes, according to the police. And Humza Yousaf said the legislation has been weaponized by people with a grudge. I think a lot of complaints were actually made about him, which is why he's probably saying that. So they're just some of the headlines that have been doing the rounds since we last spoke here on TNT. But I'm still reeling from the Bob Ross revelation, so forgive me if I'm not really concentrating.
When you come off from this little shift, I've sent you that little video clip that I was referencing in during the story. So again, I can only say this is something that people are starting to, the pennies may be dropping, people are looking into this. And somebody texted me, actually, they're listening in while I'm on air, and they went, Bob, no! So obviously there's going to be a lot of disappointed people out there if this proves to be true. But listen, it could just be a load of old bunkum. But, you know, no smoke without fire. And that squirrel shot tells me all I need to know about poor old Bob Ross and those poor old squirrels. God knows what he did to them whenever the camera lens cap went back on again. So, Gemma, thanks very much for all your input this morning. Lovely to see you back up and on form again, a little bit healthier today than you were yesterday. And tomorrow you'll be back up to full speed. We've got to take a break now and welcome Jacques Broderick on from South Africa. So don't go away. Stay tuned for more here on TNT, today's news talk.
Johnny Vedmore, TNT.
Whenever we examine evidence, we discover a range of new information. And some of the information involving the COVID-19 pandemic is truly uncomfortable. I'm still impressed by the strength of those with medical expertise who are still organizing and fighting for those who are being left behind. There is a change happening in the world, and change is extremely important. People are realizing that it is do or die, and that without a fight, this sort of tragedy will happen again. We must lift the voices of those who have been ignored, and we will be looking for those voices to come on the Johnny Vedmore Show to speak out loud and proud.
Talk that matters. Johnny Vedmore on today's News Talk, TNT.
A better business tip from TNT Radio. One reason people tune in to TNT Radio is often because they're loyal to a specific show or personality. Our personalities have been a part of people's daily routine, and people continue to tune in.
They trust TNT Radio
and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
Today's News Talk Radio.
I do a lot of streaming radio.
I do a lot of free streaming.
TNTradio.live.
Yes, live, uncensored, unscripted. I'm very happy to be talking this morning for the first time with Jacques Broederick. I hope I've pronounced the name correctly. Broederick or Broederick from South Africa. Before I go any further, have I got the name right? Is it Broederick?
That's close enough. Well done for a foreigner.
Appreciate that. Jacques is the chief spokesperson for the AfriForum in South Africa. He's also a specialist in community safety. He's a close protection officer and a filmmaker based in South Africa. I'm personally very happy to talk to you this morning because I've tried to cover South Africa in at least once or twice a month here in as part of the show that I'm doing, even though I'm based in the UK. I've had some great guests on from South Africa, a chap called K9 Reaper, who has a great Twitter or X account. He's involved in the same type of business as you in South Africa, and also Rob Hutchinson, who runs the Dear South Africa website as well. So really happy to be talking to you this morning, Jacques. How's life been treating you down in the southernmost tip of Africa?
Yeah, thank you very much for the opportunity. Things are interesting as always down here. We're heading towards elections, so that's bringing up it's a unique perspective, and you know, interesting things like we haven't had load shedding for more than 2 weeks, seeing as we're heading towards elections. There are positives to it as well.
Yeah, the load shedding, by the way, for anybody that's outside of South Africa, we would refer to that as rolling blackouts, which is a very intermittent electricity supply that you guys have had there. And I know that that's something that you've been having to deal with for years now, as because of Eshcom, the so-called electricity provider there. You could have 12 hours on, 12 hours off, rolling blackouts, we call them, load shedding, moving up in stages, stage 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I think at one stage you guys were at stage 6 or 7 load shedding out there, which meant life was pretty difficult to run a business or to, you know, stay online because there was simply no power.
Yeah, no, that's true. And one of the other major issues, apart from the economic and social impact, is obviously it gives a lot of rise to criminalistic opportunistic criminals. So, as you know, cable theft is a major problem in South Africa, stealing of copper cable, of electricity wires. So when the power is down, these guys know exactly where the power is down, and they just steal kilometers worth of electric fencing, of underground electric wiring. And when your load shedding stage ends, your power just never comes back on. And I need to find out that these guys stole the cables while the power was off.
Mm-hmm. The thing about crime as well, Jacques, you are involved as a community safety officer, close protection officer. I don't think people outside of South Africa realize just what it's like in terms of crime in your neck of the woods at the minute. And of course, it's not the whole country. The whole country is not infested with crime, but there are areas and certain hotspots that were it not for community safety programs and people working in the close protection business, effectively, there would be complete lawlessness in certain areas of South Africa. So it's a necessity that chaps like you have to put together the programs that you do. Otherwise, it would simply be no law and order whatsoever.
Yeah, that's unfortunately absolutely correct. And I'd go so as far as to say that I would challenge you on that. I would say that the whole country is infested with crime. It just tends to, the types of crime tend to differ from area to area, depending on what's available there and the socioeconomic circumstances, etc. But crime is a major problem everywhere. So I'll give you an idea. AfriForum as an organization started setting up neighborhood watches about in 2012. So since then, we've grown to 172 community safety structures countrywide with roughly 11,000 trained volunteers who patrol and police their own areas, because the South African Police Service simply isn't up to the task. So that's the scope of the problem that we're looking at, that we need to try and address.
Now, that's interesting figures that you've got there. So there's 172 effective hubs, community safety hubs that have sprang up in South Africa, 11,000 volunteers on there. How does that work, Jacques, in terms of, and where I live in Ireland, we're not allowed to own guns, okay? So owning a firearm, unless you're a farmer and you have a firearms license, you know, for, you know, on your farm for a shotgun, or you are a member of the security forces, you can carry a weapon for personal safety, personal protection. Aside from that, nobody can own guns. So the gun laws in South Africa, I'm guessing, are different. Are there extra levels of vetting that needs to go through before people can legally own a firearm yourself, for example? And if so, how does that work with regards to the criminality? There's a chap here. You posted up one of his posts. Paratus said, in all recent criminal incidents in my neighborhood involving knife-wielding thugs, all the first responders were armed with firearms, amongst other things. And when the topic of gun control is discussed in the context of blaming armed citizens for the problem, you aren't hearing from people who care about public safety. They're pursuing a civilian disarmament agenda. So does the government want to disarm guys like yourself who literally have to be armed to deal with the people that they're dealing with, or what is the governmental agenda in that respect?
Well, I think you touched on a couple of questions there, so I'm going to try and work all of them into this answer. But so first of all, gun regulation in South Africa is pretty strict if you are a law-abiding citizen. You have to apply for a license. There is a background check. There is vetting. You have to be of stable mind. You have to put. You can't have a criminal record. So it's pretty strict, and it's a process that takes quite a while because the administration is terrible. You also have to go for a competency training class that you need to pass. So it's pretty cumbersome getting a legally owned firearm in South Africa. It's not cumbersome to get an illegal firearm in South Africa. So that's the problem. From Afrifirm's side, we do everything by the book and within the confines of the law. Our patrollers who are armed legally, and they also carry their firearms and operate them in a legal way. So, you know, that's something that's very important for us. But unfortunately, the criminals that you come up against simply do not operate by the same rules than you do. So often the firepower that you find out there is much stronger, higher caliber weapons, fully automatic weapons, which the criminals have in their possession, which legally armed citizens technically cannot have in their possession. Something else you mentioned there was that we have 172 community safety structures. So that's just Afriforum's community safety structures. Mm-hmm. Now you have to take the private security industry into mind. You have to take in community policing forums into mind. You have to take in private neighborhood watches into mind. So the amount of volunteers who are doing this kind of work is actually a lot more than just 172 that are doing it in collaboration with Afriforum. Then to get to the government's disarmament program, well, the Minister of Police, who is totally incompetent for his position, should absolutely not be holding the position that he's holding. He has often made accusations and thumbsucked statistics that the fact that we have a lot of gun crime in South Africa is because legally armed citizens somehow lose their firearms or their firearms get stolen, and that's where these criminals get their firearms from, where there's absolutely nothing to prove that. All the research into this has shown that it's the opposite. The South African Police Service themselves lose, steal, and sometimes even hire out firearms to criminals to commit crimes. There was a very big case in the Western Cape a few years back where a high-ranking officer was caught, where he sold thousands and thousands of confiscated firearms to gang members in the Western Cape. So that's just a ridiculous statement to make. But we saw about 2 or 3 years ago that the South African government came out with a new proposed gun law, which had some ridiculous clauses in this proposed legislation, such as that you would not be able to allow to own a firearm for self-defense. And you also have to bear in mind that should you say someone is not allowed to own a firearm for self-defense purposes, that would include civilians and also armed security officers. So if armed security officers aren't even allowed to own firearms for their own protection or for performing their duties, then you've really got to question government's motives behind this legislation. But there was a big pushback from civil society, and that seems to have been put on hold for now, but we'll see what the future brings.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. You know, I'm interested in repercussions. For example, we talked about that post where a chap was saying that first responders were coming up against a lot of knife-wielding thugs when they were out. Thankfully, they were armed with guns, so that's obviously a deterrent. Foolish man brings a gun or a knife to a gunfight. But then what about if you're faced with another armed criminal? You're working there as a volunteer or as part of a private security firm. How would the law view, for example, a shooting in self-defense that resulted in a death? So we've got to take a 30-second headline break. When we come back at the other end, because that puts a lot of people off, you know, a lot of people are questioning, well, why do people just step back and allow these thugs to run rampant in their communities and neighborhoods? As you see in some parts of the world, that if you do defend yourself or you do take someone's life in self-defense, it could very well end up that you end up in prison for a very, very long time yourself, or you end up ruined simply for taking care of yourself or your own property. So I want to look at what the ramifications of that could be operating as a volunteer in South Africa, and we'll do that when we come back at the other side of the news here on TNT, Today's News Talk.
Time to read some news.
TNT Radio News.
For TNT, this is James O'Neill. The Israeli military has provided the government with various response options following recent Iranian airstrikes, according to IDF spokesperson Peter Lerner. In Sydney's western suburb of Wakeley, a bishop and three worshippers were stabbed during a service at Christ the Good Shepherd Church, triggering significant unrest. European Union lawmakers have officially approved a new immigration system designed to manage illegal immigration more effectively after several years of negotiation.
Why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all major social platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time right here on Today's News Talk.
TNT Radio.
TNT Radio.
Okay, Chuck, talking about ownership of firearms, obviously in the business that you guys are in, community safety, close protection. You mentioned that there are 172 hubs in association with AfriForum. There are obviously a lot more people working in this business in South Africa, private security firms, armed, okay? You're on the job, you're out doing volunteer work. In your case, someone comes at you with a knife, you believe your life is in danger. You take aim, you shoot, you put the perp down, he dies. What way does that leave you with regards to reporting that to police? Or if they're called out, would you be arrested? Is there an investigation carried out? Or what way does the law stand for protecting yourself resulting in the death of a perp?
I think that there are three main topics that we can address regarding that issue. So first of all, there's more than enough room in South African law and existing legislation for you to, if you are legally armed and you use your firearm in a legal way, to protect yourself as an act of personal defense or to protect someone else should there be a threat to your or their lives. That is absolutely acceptable and inferred in previous court judgments, etc. So secondly, what's very important doing this type of work is to know when you are allowed to use a firearm or when you are allowed to act in a certain way. So it's very important for us, for our volunteers, to know exactly how to operate within the confines of the law to prevent them from accidentally crossing those boundaries in the heat of the moment, for instance. And that's why we offer regular and quality training to all our volunteers as well, so that they make sure they know exactly where the limits are, when to act in which way. Now, thirdly, you asked about calling the police out and an investigation, etc. Yes, that's absolutely what happens. You have to get the South African Police Service out to investigate the matter. And unfortunately, there are certain circumstances where certain politics are at play or other agendas come in, and people who acted legally in personal or self-defense then get arrested and charged with, say, a murder or manslaughter. That does happen, and that is also why AfriForum offers legal standby to our patrollers. Should they find themselves in a situation like that where they conducted themselves within the confines of the law, within AfriForum's own policies and procedures, and they still get accused of something falsely, then we will back them legally as well.
So am I right in saying then that the law that applies, as you've rightly pointed out, that if your life is in threat, you are a legally owned possessor of a firearm, I'm coming at you to take your life, you shoot me dead in self-defense, that the law allows for that. Is that a blanket application of the law? And what I mean by that is, in America, for example, in some states, people can just come and squat in your house and you really don't have any recompense to come back and kick them out in some states of America. Other places like Florida, it's like, well, if someone breaks into your house and you think you're at risk, you could just shoot them dead. You crack on and go ahead with it. So you have different laws applying depending on whether or not a state is Republican, predominantly Republican or predominantly Democrat. I know there's a lot of areas and regions within South Africa. So does that law apply on a blanket level, or is it applied more stringently in some places and more loosely in other places?
Well, let me first just be clear about that. There's no specific law on self-defense in South Africa, but this is how the law and how the actions are interpreted through previous court judgments that have made ample room for you to be able to protect yourself legally. This is the principle of self-defense or personal defense is something that still comes from Roman Dutch law. From Roman law, it's a very old principle, and it's accepted in most countries in the world. I would almost say is all of the countries in the world. Sometimes it's interpreted differently, but I mean, you have that absolute right. You have a right to life. You're allowed to protect that right. So I think that's very important to note. But yes, the Criminal Procedures Act in South Africa, which mostly governs with all kinds of crime and trespasses, is a national law. It's a national legislation. And even though we might have some municipalities or provinces who are governed by other parties or coalition parties, apart from the African National Congress, they still can't change national laws and regulations.
Mm. The reason why I'm asking all this to you is I've been watching the developments in South Africa since TNT started, which was in January of 2022. And when I first had South African guests on, I couldn't believe the state that the country was in general. So when I mentioned crime at the beginning, I was trying to give the benefit of the doubt, saying, well, it's not absolutely everywhere. But as you rightly said, well, actually it is. It's only to what degree the crime is rampant. It could be more violent in certain places, more opportunistic looting happening in other places. Unemployment levels are crazy. I couldn't believe the electricity situation as well with the load shedding, and also water supplies as well are very questionable at this point in time. The country doesn't look to be in a great state at the moment, Jacques. And I suppose what I'm trying to say is the type of business that you're in, I would say the demand for that is increasing over the last few years rather than decreasing, which would suggest maybe that the country's more going towards instability than stability. Would that be a fair assessment, or what's your take on that just as we close this off?
Yeah, unfortunately, I would have to agree that that is a fair assessment. Things haven't been looking up in this country for many, many years. Every year seems to be getting a little worse. But it doesn't mean that we need to get negative or we need to get hopeless. That is exactly why organizations like AfriForum do the groundwork level work that they do. I mean, we don't just do community safety. We set up emergency water points we have branches in our active communities. We fix potholes. We try and provide medical services where possible, or at least fight against government further eroding the public health sector or turning the private sector into another mess under government control. So there are always avenues for us to make a difference and for us to actually take things charge and take matters into our own hands within the confines of the law in a positive and a productive way. And that's what we like to focus on at AfriForum. We don't lose hope. We look at solutions, and that's what we focus on.
Well, I like the positivity there and the summary that you've just gave us there, that although things are pretty grim at the minute, there is still hope. And if you don't have any hope and you lose hope, then you're in this state of despair, your head goes down, and then you're no good to anybody at all. Jacques, we're out of time on this one. If I can direct people towards AfriForum, if you use the X or Twitter platform, you can search for them at AFRI Forum, and also they have a website, afriforum.co.za. You can see what those guys are up to down there, or get in contact with them if you need to. So massive thanks to you. We only had a short time this morning and we're only scratching on the surface of some of the issues that you're dealing with over there, but I really thank you for going into depth with those answers and replies. And maybe we can talk again sooner rather than later, because this situation in your neck of the woods ain't going away anytime soon. And we do have a lot of listeners from the South Africa area also, so I'm sure they would be very interested in hearing what else you have to say on this matter. So big thanks to you this morning, Jacques. I hope you have a great day down there in South Africa. I've got to take a break now and welcome Ben Pylon from the UK. So stay tuned for more here on TNT, Today's News Talk.
Hi, I'm Susan Lucci. I never thought about heart disease until I had my own heart event. At first, like so many other women out there, I ignored my symptoms. A slight pressure on my chest, shortness of breath. I thought, I don't have time to be sick. I had a 90% blockage in my main artery and a 75% blockage in the adjacent artery. I received 2 stents in my arteries. Stents developed through research funded by the American Heart Association. Those stents saved my life. I'm so grateful to the American Heart Association. Their research helped save my life. I can enjoy life with my children, my grandchildren, and my friends. Please, listen to your heart. The only reason I'm here today is because I did. Learn more about the American Heart Association's life-saving work at helpheart.org.
Around here, bushfire is just a part of life. We've been through it before, and we'll get through it again. The people here all look out for each other. We're a community that does its bit to plan and prepare, to keep everyone safe. We live with bushfire, so we live bushfire ready.
In a secret lab, somewhere in the Western Hemisphere, the perfect human specimen has been born. He has the strength of 10 men and the wisdom of 20.
Rick Munn.
Now you listen here. There's a very naughty boy.
TNT Radio.
Now go away.
Well, don't go away just yet. We still have another 20 minutes of magic to bring to you lovely people before the show ends today. And no better way to end the show than to talk to my old sparring partner from the UK, none other than Mr. Ben Tyle. Ben is an independent researcher. He's a writer. He's a net zero critic. I think that's an understatement. And also a skeptic and the founder of Climate Debate UK. Ben, welcome back to TNT Towers. How are you doing today?
All very good, Rick. Thanks, apart from the winter's come back. But yeah, just for having me back.
Yeah, yesterday was a funny old day. I put a post up on the old social media talking about the extremes that I experienced here in Northern Ireland. It was snowing briefly for a period yesterday morning. The wind chill got apparently down to -2. Then the sky went blue and it was sunshine. Then torrential downpours and then the heat was up and down. I thought it was just me, but I had people from Scotland, England, Wales, from Isle of Man, from all over the UK saying, hey, it's been exactly like that where I am too. Is that not a little bit odd? I get that a certain area could have extremes in weather in one day. That's not that unusual. But for the whole of the UK to experience that yesterday, all the seasons in one day for the whole country, is that not a little bit bizarre?
It just feels a bit more like March than April, I guess. But yeah, but don't forget, it's cold because it's hot. There you go. Right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Roasting. So I mean, it might look like it's snowing, but really everything's getting really hot and dangerous. So,
yeah,
so be careful.
Birmingham Mail told us yesterday that be prepared to be roasted this weekend because temperatures could be increasing by 20 degrees Celsius. Well, yesterday there were -2 where I was. So for them to increase by 20, it still puts us at 18 Celsius. I don't know about you, my friend, but when I roast a leg of lamb or a good topside joint in the oven, it usually takes 200 plus Celsius to do that. 20 degrees C, I don't think we're going to be roasting, do you?
Maybe it's a slow roast. I saw that article though, and it had that Jim Dale quoted Jim Dale extensively, the meteorologist who's often on at GB News and Talk TV and other disreputable news stations like Sky. So it just seems like anyone can weave any kind of climate change story out of thin air, and then. You know, well, I mean, we used to that stuff. A lot of tabloids sort of produce these kind of stories out of pure speculation, because it's sort of titillating, isn't it? It's sort of, oh, it's going to be an Arctic blast and we're going to be roasting in an Arctic blast, or somehow linking really, really cold weather to global warming. We have to suffer that.
Are people buying this, right? And the reason I ask that is obviously we can see through it. When you see these weather maps now, you know, a lot of people are doing screenshots where they're comparing the weather maps of 2024 with the weather maps of, say, 1975, 1985. So when the weather was 20 degrees Celsius, for example, it would be green on the map. Now it's this blood red color, this hellish, hellfire, sulfur dioxide red color on the weather maps. Yeah. Is that having an effect? Are people pouring scorn on it? Now, I know some people will buy into this. I know people have been suckered and bought into this, Ben, but is it a little bit like, you know, if they tried to bring back masking now, or the veneers worn off with the vaccines, the uptake on them is so low now, are they wasting their time trying to push this hyper narrative now, or are people seeing through this for the BS that it actually is?
Well, just on the question of whether changing the color maps is a kind of nudge, I guess we'd only ever know if we were a party to that conversation. Just go, oh, let's make the weather maps red rather than where they used to be green and blue and what have you, and try to make everything scary. Now, I've got a difference of opinion on these psychological techniques and this nudging and this kind of head shrinking to try and get us all to be obedient to the climate narrative. And what you're saying, I agree with. It seems to be, you see these kind of silly reports with these silly weather forecasters telling everyone about how terrible the weather is now compared to the past, which, you know, you have to then go and dig up all the stuff, all the research, and you have to go and look up all the numbers and so on and so forth if you really want to find out. But I think it just wears people out. I think people become immune to it. And I actually think what's happened is people have become resistant to it. And there's actually a school of thought, if you can call it either of those things, in climate change psychology, because there is such a thing now, that is in at odds with another one. So one lot of people think you've got to kind of maintain this nudging, maintaining this kind of constant expert barraging of the public into obedience. And another school of thought, which probably is flawed in many ways, but they're right on this. They've got this theory called, I think it's called reticence or reactance, yeah. I think probably more likely. And that says the more you nudge people, the more they're just going to push back, and the more they're going to just be resistant to it. And more than that, they're going to be wise to this kind of manipulation. Because at that kind of level, often the way these kind of people, these kind of organizations talk to people is very condescending. And people, most people in Britain and the UK and probably most of Western Europe, they don't like to be spoken down to in that way. They, you know, it's like don't you find when you're being patronized, your antenna are going, mm-hmm. Yeah. Just go away. And you know, so they poured millions and millions and millions of pounds into this kind of research and into the, you know, famously the nudge unit in the under mm-hmm. the UK government, the PSYOPs, you know, kind of a branch of government to get everyone to behave. But I think it's all for naught. Like, kind of everything they try and do to try and make us behave is not yielding results for them. No. In terms of support for the policy agenda. Nobody's buying EVs. Nobody wants to have a gas to replace their gas. Well, I mean, a few people do, but they're just the sort of outlier lunatics. They were going to try and get 600,000 people a year to get heat pumps. I don't even think they're getting 10% of that, even with the offer of free money to do it. I think you get about £8,000 to do that from the government. So it's way beyond a nudge. That's a sort of like a huge inducement. You'd think people would be, you know, tearing the doors down to try and get that kind of free money, but they just ain't. And so all the what is happening, as we can see in Germany, in France, in the Netherlands, and even in Poland, and even a bit here as well, is tractors heading to capital cities, not so many eco warriors. So we've not been mobilized by the likes of Extinction Rebellion or slick PR campaigns or psychological head shrinking. We're all going, no, this is just not for us. And so I think, you know, that's a reaction, if nothing else, to that condescending view of people from not just from psychologists, but from government itself. If government thinks it's okay to hire silly psychologists to sort of drag up the dregs of that kind of what used to happen in the Soviet Union, to sort of impose that stuff on people, well, people are just going to see through that. They're going to say, "You, this is what you think of us. This is your statement of what we are." Well, GFY, you know, we're going to vote for something else. And then, of course, that creates this whole great big new reaction. There's whereby if you say, "I don't like wind farms very much and I don't want an EV," they'll go, "Oh, my God, far right, which is a whole new level of nudging, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, and not wanting an EV, let's look at some real facts. This is some real facts and figures here coming out of Ireland. And I thought, I shared this story with you, I sent you this yesterday to have a look at. I thought it might put a wry smile on your face. So you talk actually about the amount of money that's being spent pushing certain agendas here. In Ireland, a report was published yesterday on Grip Media that despite the Green Party leader, Eamon Ryan over here in Ireland, a report was published yesterday on Grip Media that despite the Green Party leader, Eamon Ryan over here in Ireland, promising last year a 100 million euro plan to promote EVs, we're seeing the registrations drop off a cliff. Now, we're not seeing a little seasonal blip here, Ben. We're talking about year-on-year sales. So EV sales are plummeting in Ireland. New EV registrations are down 40% from this time last year. And that's figures from the Society of Irish Motor Industry. So these are not some right-wing extremist propaganda groups here. These are actual figures coming from Irish motoring societies here. 40% drop over the past two decades of EV market expansion. Costly EVs were only accessible to the rich. Tesla's first cars were priced in at about 100 grand. But a research paper from the Energy Institute of Business in California found that only 10% of US households with an EV are single vehicle households, compared to 37% of all households. Now that's in America. And of course, ownership has dropped off the cliff here in Ireland. I think it's undoubted. Listen, I think you've adopted this attitude in the past, and I always remember your quote that having an EV is a bridge to owning no vehicle at all. If you want to go down that route, you should be free to go down that route. If you want to EV yourself up, then you should be free to do it. I think where we have the issue, Ben, is when governments are spending hundreds of millions of euros to push this agenda down our throat, only for us to find out that A, it's exorbitantly expensive. B, there's no residual values in these vehicles. C, they could potentially burst into fire at any time. And D, you've got ranging anxiety, charging anxiety, range, if you can manage to find yourself a place. And yesterday, I think it was actually Bruce Scott put a picture up that they're now bringing in overhead charging cables in certain places that if you don't have a driveway and, you know, they can't have cables across the footpath, you try and park outside your house, get one of these installed, and then run almost a hose up and over the top of the pavement into your car to charge it overnight. Who in their right bloody mind is going to buy into that nonsense?
You can have all this spaghetti down these streets in,
I'm telling you,
across,
man,
the entire country. I mean, they don't seem to understand that most people live in terraced houses. And yes, even if you could do this so that it didn't look like a right old mess with these ropes hanging across the street, then you've still got to connect this extra demand to the supply. You've got to dig up all the roads again, and you've got to put in much thicker power cables to get from the generators to street level, because at the moment they're not capable of carrying the sheer wattage or amps, whichever way you want to look at it, from the grid to your car. So if everyone in your street turns their car on at the same time, then of course that's going to blow a view somewhere at the moment. And indeed, like in some places, you can't get planning permission for a charger because for precisely that problem. There's already too much demand on the grid because the population is exploding and no one's investing in the infrastructure. And now, of course, we learn, I think today or certainly this week, they're gonna legislate such that now smart meters are going to be able to do time of day pricing. So you might have left your car on charge if you can resolve all those problems, but there might not even be enough capacity on the grid in any case, even if the grid was capable of delivering the power to your car. So assuming none of those problems are present, you might end up have put your car on charge, and then the smart meter has decided that it's going to cost you £1 a minute. You know, because there's going to be scarcity on the grid. So you know, this just has not been thought through, and from the outset, from 20 years ago, you know, there was a design idea which was extremely superficial. We're all going to be living these lifestyles in which our carbon emissions have been massively reduced. And we're going to do it. We're going to have heat pumps, we're going to have EVs, and we're going to have solar panels on roofs. But no one actually did any of the sums. And many of those technologies just don't exist. There isn't the battery technology to store grid to store power at the grid level. There isn't the technology to give EVs make EVs economic for the use case that I'm in. For example, I always buy cars at the end of their life. They might last me 5, might last me 10 years if I'm really lucky, but I'm always the last owner because I buy budget economic cars. And there's no drop-in replacement for domestic gas bills. So that nobody has ever thought, there's never been in government the other side presented about these essentially unicorn schemes to say, well, what if this doesn't work? What if we hit a bump in the road? What if the economy falters? What if you can't do carbon and capture and storage? What if hydrogen energy is hopelessly inefficient and ruinously expensive? Yet that every stage, every time the government and wonks encounter a problem with for example wind technology, rather than going maybe we should sort of go back a few steps, maybe even go back to square one and look at the plans we've got, they just double down, and it's just going to get messier and messier and messier as these problems cascade through each other. I mean, I don't want to be doomy about it, but
yeah, you do.
Yeah, no. I want to say that we can change all this.
Yeah,
you know, it's within our power to stop this agenda. But it does take quite a lot of organisation to counter the resources that the green blob and the governments have at their disposal, and to put them on the right track. And of course, you know, even if I would say the last year we've seen remarkable change in the Tory government, or at least in parts of the Westminster Conservative Party, but now just a small number of them are realizing the mess that they've caused. We're about to get a super Labour majority for the other side. They're going to go through the same process, and maybe if we're still talking, if we're still allowed to talk after that government in 4 years' time or so, we'll be having a conversation about how even Labour ministers are recognising that net zero is poorly conceived. But I'm hoping that. So yeah, I'm a bit doomish, but I still think we've got potential here to change.
We have got potential, and listen, a story like that one that we're discussing about the Irish EV market, for example. Listen, that's the evidence that things are starting to crumble, because people, you know, they vote with their wallets and they vote with their feet. And if people are moving away from purchasing these vehicles, and one of the reasons that was given, you know, people were asked the question, well, what would put you off, for example, buying an EV at this time? One of the main reasons was the concern over residual value. So these things are really expensive to buy in the first place. And then if you want to trade that in, or, you know, it comes up to 2 or 3 years and you're fortunate enough to be able to replace it if that's how you operate. The residual values are dropping off the charts in this one. So people think, well, if I buy that thing for 40 grand, it can only be worth maybe 10 or 15,000 in 3 years, maybe. Or if I want to transition back to a diesel car or an internal combustion engine car again, something reliable, something I know is going to be roadworthy and I'm not going to have to stop every 100 miles and charge it up, then they're going to realize they're going to take a massive financial hit on doing that. And a lot of dealerships as well, Ben, are struggling at the minute because the amount of used stock sitting on their forecourts, nobody is buying it up. And while I don't wish any financial woes on anybody because I know it's tight out there trying to make ends meet and run a business, but if you've went all in on the EV market and you believe that that's the future of motoring, I think there's going to be a lot of dealers with very burnt fingertips, and obviously a lot of buyers as well that were buying these cars up whose bubbles burst as well. So I'm not relishing that, and I know you're not relishing that either, but I believe it is an indicator that slowly, as we do continue to apply the pressure on these narratives, what you're doing, for example, with climate debate, what we're trying to do here together on TNT, I do think it is making a difference, and maybe it's making people pause before they jump in there with both feet and make a purchase that they'll sorely regret at another time. But listen, the music's playing, the rock music is playing in my ear. That means it's time to wrap it up. Ben Pyle, massive thanks to you as always for taking time out to talk to us this morning. Check him out on Twitter or X at Climate, CLIM number 8 Resistance, or his website climatedebate.co.uk. Go and show him some love and support on there. That's Ben Pyle. I'm Rick Munn. I'm out of here, but I'll be back again for my sins back to purgatory tomorrow morning, 11 a.m. UK time up until 1. So stay tuned for more James Freeman's incoming on TNT, Today's News Talk.